Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of August. Last Saturday's shooting and death of an unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown, the protests, the police response, the tension between police force and the African-American community, the events this week in Ferguson, Missouri, the first hour of our program. We'll begin with a columnist for the African-American Weekly, the St. Louis American. Ishmael Sistrunk has been documenting the protests, and he's written an important piece, Walking While Black, Michael Brown, Black Men and White Police Officers. He is from just 5 minutes away from Ferguson. That's where he grew up, and he was at a church in Ferguson, very close to the site of the shooting of Michael Brown when it took place last week. Later, Professor Joshua Carell on the association between race and the idea of threat. Just to update you on the news, NPR reported on some of the president's comments. He spoke today. AP report says he kept a measured tone and urged calm. Actually, it's a Fox News report. He said law enforcement officials on the ground should not be arresting journalists, which happened last night, and to allow protesters to form peacefully. He also told protesters that they should not target police officers, which also happened yesterday. The president said there is never an excuse for violence against police or those who would use this tragedy as a cover for vandalism or looting. He urged police transparency in the investigation, which of course has been heavily criticized by many. There are two completely different versions of what happened last Saturday. We will talk about that and, of course, the response, which has been getting attention all over the world with our first guest. And welcoming your phone calls, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Ishmael, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for the commentary that you wrote. I think it is extremely important. And you grew up, I guess, just a few minutes away from Ferguson.
Yes, I grew up in a municipality called Berkeley, which is about 5 minutes from where the Ferguson police station is. So I'm very familiar with this area and with the North County area in general, which Ferguson and Berkeley are both a part of.
Mm-hmm. You've been, I know, covering the protests. Can you give us an update of what happened last night, what's happening today in Ferguson?
Well, today is a stark contrast to last night. I've been out here with the protesters. I'm about two blocks away from where the protests are going right now. And today is a lot more peaceful and calm. The St. Louis County Police Department has, I guess, been ordered to pull out by Governor Nixon, and so protesters are able to march and protest peacefully, which they're doing. Last night was the complete opposite. There was a militarized police force. We saw armored vehicles, police who were in riot gear. They were shooting off stun grenades, tear gas at largely peaceful protesters. There were some reports that a bottle was thrown or maybe a few rocks were thrown at officers. But again, they were in full body armor before they launched that attack against the protesters.
Ishmael, do we have any indication of when we're going to find out the truth about what happened last Saturday?
Not at this point. There's really been not too much information revealed from the police department as far as the name of the officer or any details. They said that they want to protect the officer's safety, which is understandable, but at the same time, that information needs to be released so that, number one, the press can do their due diligence to find out, is there a history of this going on? But so far, the city of Ferguson and the police department have not really released too much information. They haven't been too cooperative with the media.
And what are your sources are telling you? Do you have an indication of what happened, or are you in the dark as well?
Well, there have been various eyewitness accounts that, you know, I guess at this point are unverified, but they seem to tell the same narrative as far as the situation, what happened. The gentlemen were apparently walking in the middle of the street in their neighborhood, And the police officer in question passed them by. He told them to get out of the street. They told him, you know, hey, we're going to that house, you know, right here. The officer started to pull off and I guess came back. And that's when everything just spun out of control. But it seems like for kids walking in their own neighborhood, it just seemed like it was excessive from the start.
I know the Department of Justice has sent people there to conduct, I don't know, some kind of sensitivity training. Has that begun already?
I'm not sure. I haven't got any word of that having started. I don't believe so because the Department of Justice, they're really just beginning their intervention into this situation. And St. Louis County, again, they just pulled out their forces this morning. But I can't imagine that they would have time to have begun that sensitivity training. It certainly wasn't into effect looking at how it was handled last night.
The piece that you wrote is interesting because you call on the Black community to be responsible, and you also give an understanding of what it's like to be a young Black man in this area where you grew up. I mean, you tell some incredible stories. You were pulled over by the police more than 50 times, you say, and some of the reasons were you had snow on your license plate and it was snowing out.
It was snowing outside. I remember that vividly. And there are plenty of stories. You know, obviously writing for a print publication, I couldn't tell every example, so I just noted a few. But those type of situations, it's not unique to me. That's the sad thing. I wish my story was the only one like that. But most of my friends, most people around my age or even younger now who are growing up, they have those same experiences. And it's just an issue of the police wanting to assert their control. They stop you. They ask you, hey, what are you doing? Where are you going? I've been frisked by police officers with no weapons, no anything that's harmful, you know, just because, hey, this is what we feel like doing. We feel like you're a threat. So I felt it was important to tell that story, for one, so that other young African-Americans today, they know that, you know, someone understands, someone has been through the same thing. And also for people who are not in this situation that may not understand, where this seems foreign to them, where they can just get a firsthand account and understand why there's tension between especially the young African-American community and the police or law officials.
It's my understanding that this community, Ferguson, is 70% African-American. The police force is 53 officers, and only 3 officers are African-American. Hasn't anybody addressed that disparity?
The disparity has been discussed. It's definitely something that I think they will have to acknowledge. They will have to change. But again, that's another thing where it's not unique just to Ferguson, but all throughout St. Louis County, you know, specifically North and Mid County, you have high percentages of African American population, but the law enforcement and the government don't represent that. They're still highly Caucasian, and that's a problem. The lack of representation is just not boding well for the citizens of the community.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the violence and the looting that took place, particularly last weekend, and you talk about it being disheartening to watch young children being ushered into stores through broken glass windows to grab free trinkets, young Black men videotaping themselves looting and eventually burning down the Quick Trip. You go on to say it was wrong, it was reprehensible, it was also inevitable. Why was it inevitable?
I think it was inevitable because anytime you have a sustained oppression, I guess, or a system where especially young Black men are just not respected at all, at some point that's gonna blow over. You know, at some point those tensions are just gonna get too much. And I don't think that this was, again, just St. Louis, but we see this nationwide where we see a lot of young Black men were getting killed by police officers, and there's no repercussions for it. We see the officers, they get a They get a paid vacation, essentially, or administrative leave. They're exonerated of any charges, and they come back on the force. And so St. Louis is one of the more segregated municipal areas in America. So just everyone having these similar experiences, it just eventually builds up. And when you see just such egregious acts that we've seen, it was bound to happen.
Do you have any idea where the word came from today? I know it was just announced that there would be a different kind of response starting today to protesters. Do you know who gave that order and what kind of response, the second question is, you think is needed to keep order?
Well, I believe that response came from the governor, Jay Nixon. He is the one who, I believe, turned over the police response from the St. Louis County Police to the state police. So St. Louis County, they are the officers who were there last night, again, with the armored vehicles and the riot gear, and just had a heavy-handed response to peaceful protesters. So now that the county police officers are out, as I'm here today, it's a much more peaceful process. I didn't see any police officers, unless they were just driving by and passing, there really was no police presence out in front of the Ferguson City Hall. And the result of that is the people are marching peacefully. There's no problems. There's no issues whatsoever. It's just people launching their peaceful protest.
You describe yourself as a lifelong St. Louis resident. Your mother had to, as soon as you got your driver's license, talk to you about how you would become a prime target for police officers. You've talked about this being a very segregated part of the country, and I speak to you from an area that's as segregated, probably Milwaukee. But I'm wondering, with all of this tension being there, with all of these problems that you experienced and that your friends have experienced and probably a lot of young African-American males, why is it that all these years have gone by and nobody's addressed these issues of race in the community?
That's a great question. I think part of it is just leadership. Because our city is so segregated and it's not just white and black, but even within the black community, there are fractions. So there was just never enough togetherness or cohesion to properly formulate a plan to address it. We just weren't on the same page. The younger generation, the older generation, Caucasians, other minorities. So now I think with this issue happening and the world being here, you know, we see media from all over the world, it's being broadcast all over the world.
Right.
It has to be addressed. There's no way that it can be covered up now. There's no way that it can be brushed under the table. It has to be addressed, and I think that's what's going to happen.
And when you talk about this, you say that not all police officers are bad. People with the power to take away your life or freedom, however, should be held to a higher standard. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, you know, I don't want to insinuate that all police officers are bad or evil, because they're not. And I have some friends that are police officers. I've had great experience with police officers. But when you have, it's the same way with the looting. When you have bad apples or people who are doing bad, they make everybody look bad. So the looting that happened on Sunday night, that gave a negative tone to this whole situation. With the police officers, you have to acknowledge that there are police officers who behave badly. And I think the big reason that this situation was so explosive is far too often when we see young black men get killed, again, the police officers don't suffer any consequences. It's such a fraternity that they look out for themselves. So I think the law enforcement officials have to acknowledge there are police officers who do the wrong thing. And when that happens, you can't try to cover it up. You know, even in this situation, they haven't released very much information at all. Mm-hmm. So it appears to be a cover-up. Even if it's not, it has the appearance of being a cover-up. So you have to be transparent, and you should want to get those officers out of the force so that you can have a positive relationship with the community and you can protect and serve instead of policing and pointing weapons at protesters like we saw last night.
You also are calling in your piece on African Americans and African American males, I assume. You say we need to clean up our image, clean up our neighborhoods. We can't turn a blind eye to black on black crime, then riot and rally when an officer kills one of our young in cold blood. Is that a part of the discussion now as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think it's a secret in a lot of urban areas, St. Louis, Chicago, L.A., I'm not familiar with Milwaukee, but there's a lot of black-on-black crime in mm-hmm. the inner cities and the impoverished areas. So if we want to really foster change, we have to be able to address what we can. We have to be able to start that conversation. And part of that is to stop promoting such negative images. You know, I talked about hip-hop music. I still listen to a lot of hip-hop music, but a lot of it, it's so negative, you know, where people are talking about dealing drugs or people are talking about violent topics or things like that. And that's the image that we portray in reality TV shows. You know, we see people, women fighting each other, and that's the image that we gravitate towards. And when that happens, when you get people outside of the black community, when you get people who don't have those day-to-day interactions, and that's all they see on TV or that's all they hear on the radio, that's what they expect. So I think the first step in not being seen as threats is to step away from that image, stop embracing those negative, those violent connotations.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, I've been following the news reports on this very carefully, but when you talk about the governor was supposed to be there today, but he wanted things to cool down a bit before he arrived. The president has sent people from the Justice Department there, and he has spoken about it. But I'm wondering if you have any leaders who have entered Ferguson to just sit down and have some really serious conversations with the police and with members of the community. And, I mean, who's in charge?
Well, that may happen today. I think
I see.
Before today, it was difficult because of the police presence. We saw State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. She's actually the senator for the area that Ferguson is in. She was down in the group one of the days where she got tear gassed, and she asked the mayor during a press conference, am I going to get tear gassed again? I'm your state senator. And his response was, oh, well, I hope not.
Right.
So we've had Alderman Antonio French from St. Louis City. He's been down there documenting it, doing an amazing job, covering it on Twitter and Vine. He was arrested yesterday. Basically, he was sitting in his car, and they arrested him. I think they tried to charge him with obstruction of justice. He spent the night in jail last night. So we have leaders that are down here, but a lot of them are being treated just like everybody else. So they're being arrested. They're being harassed. So the government really, until today, where we see this change of tone, where the governor interjected, President Obama interjected, now we see a change of tone, but beforehand they were treated just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm. There were journalists, a Washington Post journalist as well and a Huffington Post journalist were arrested.
Right.
They were at McDonald's trying to do their jobs. What happened with cameras last night? I was watching television coverage, and someone made the point that the police said, you know, get rid of your cameras, and we weren't seeing any live coverage after, I can't even remember what time it was, 10 o'clock our time. Were cameras not to be used? Did the police confiscate them, or they just everybody turned them off because they were worried, or what?
No, the police have made a sustained effort. This whole situation, since it uncovered, the police have made a very, very clear that they don't want to be photographed. They don't want to be videotaped. So I think the gentleman with the Washington Post, that was part of the reason that he was arrested, because he was filming the officers as they were in the McDonald's. So we have definitely heard reports that officers have confiscated people's phones, even dealing with the actual the killing of Michael Brown. We've heard that eyewitnesses, that their phones were confiscated.
Oh, really?
The same throughout the week, where officers have said, hey, turn that videotape off. And if people argue and say, no, I have the right to film, they'll either take it or they'll try to rough them up. I'm sure you've probably seen the footage with the Al Jazeera
Yes.
News station where they shot the tear gas at them, and then they actually went and picked up the lights, picked up the cameras, set them down, turned them off. So there's a very concerted effort to suppress this video. But the fact that social media is alive and well, you can't get rid of all of it. So I don't even understand. It makes them look really bad trying to do that, because there was a AM radio station where they were live streaming it the whole way. Even after the major news stations went off the air, they had someone down there live streaming. Or if you follow, you know, people on Twitter, they had video up, and we were retweeting and sending out as much information that we could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to be. It's America, right? We're
right.
Supposed to know what's going on.
Yeah, freedom of the press.
Absolutely. And finally, we don't want to miss, of course, the tragedy for the family and for the community, Michael Brown's death, 18-year-old about to go to college. Do you have any contact with the family? Is there a burial that's scheduled for him? Do you know?
I do not know. I have personally have not had any contact with his family. I know that some of the leaders in the community have. I believe my editor at the St. Louis American may have talked to either someone in his family or a representative for the family. But I also manage the website. So last night I was up late loading stories, managing the social media. So I personally have not had any contact with them.
And we can find, I know you're on Twitter. Where do we find all your reporting, Ishmael?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's my name, Ishmael Sistrunk. It's at ISHMAELSISTRUNK. It's probably better to just follow me at the St. Louis American account, which I manage as well. And most of my work has been from there, or our website is www.stlamerican.com.
Okay. Do you have time to take one or two calls? You can tell me if you don't. It's okay.
Sure. Yeah,
all right,
no problem.
Good. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Ferguson, this part of the program. Ishmael Sistrunk is our guest. We will post what he had to write. It's a very, very poignant and direct and, I think, good commentary that he wrote. It is Walking While Black, Michael Brown, Black Men and White Police Officers. So that will be on our Facebook page. Our number is 800-486-8655. What do you make of what's been going on? He can tell you, because he's been following these protests from Ferguson, and he's from the area. He grew up in the area and was stopped by police officers, as many young African-American men are. For essentially driving while black on trumped up charges that really don't make much sense. A couple of them were legit, but many of them were just pretty wild. How do we deal with this? How should police departments deal with this? What should happen in terms of training for the Ferguson Police Department? Does it make a difference to have a racial balance if you're policing a community that's 70% African American? Where is leadership on this to try to assert calm? There's been a change coming from the governor or whoever else that the police need to change their tactics, and evidently they have today. We welcome your phone calls, and we'll take a few of them before we change guests. Ray in Milwaukee. He's our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, I was listening to overnight radio, AM radio, and all the right-wing talk show hosts are saying this is kind of Gestapo militarized police force being trained in military-style operations on how to deal with the population. And when the right-wing and the libertarians are jumping on this, this should really make the police think. And we're just one incident in Milwaukee from this happening here, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more. We've heard that phrase used, a military-style response to this. Is it in terms of the weapons, the way they're dressed? How do you characterize a military style? Would you agree with it, Ishmael? And is it a normal police response?
No, I don't think it's a normal police response by any means, especially for what's been actually occurring on the ground. But yeah, when the people talk about militarized police response, when you look at the photos, I mean, you literally can't tell whether this is in America or this is in a war zone. Mm. The police, they have full body armor. They have shields. They have helmets. They have armored vehicles. They're not tanks, but they look like it to the average person. And you have those officers on top of those tanks or around with M16s or assault rifles. Oh. and they're pointing them at the crowd. Actually, last night we had two of our female reporters who had these assault weapons pointed at their chest with the laser dot on their chest of female reporters who are there trying to do their job. So I do think it is a military style response, and I think it's very heavy handed.
Well, you can hardly do your job if you've got something like that pointed at you, right?
Right, absolutely. I think that's the point. I think that, you know, especially with the reporters or with the people who are sending out on social media, they didn't want this imagery to get out. But again, there's a freedom of the press. There was no curfew last night. But once it hit dark is when you really saw the police ramp up and try to get everybody dispersed, even though they were still just peacefully protesting.
Is there a curfew tonight?
No, there's no official curfew at all. There wasn't one last night when the mayor was asked directly, is there a curfew? They said, no, but we would like you to stop protesting at dark. But again, with St. Louis County being pulled completely out, I think tonight will be a completely different story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be watching. Pat in Iowa, hi.
Is there a First Amendment encroachment here on taking reporters' cameras?
Yes, I think there's been a lot of First Amendment violations. I mean, I guess ultimately we will see what happens with the judicial system, but I'm sure that entities like the Washington Post and the Huffington Post, they're going to try to prosecute those violations to the fullest. You may be able to intimidate residents who may not have the funding, but when you start to arrest national reporters, they're going to go through and they're going to follow up with this issue. There's also ACLU representatives that are on the ground. They contacted us at the St. Louis American. They've contacted other people. There are lawyers here, actually, right at the Ferguson police officer who are asking, hey, have you been mistreated by the police? And there's talk of some type of class action lawsuit. So I think there definitely have been violations and people will take that up in court. And we'll just have to see how it plays out.
One more call for you, Gloria in Beach Park, Illinois. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Go right ahead, Gloria.
I just wanted to say that, you know, this is nothing new. This is a problem that's been going on in especially the poor African-American neighborhoods. But more importantly, I wanted to say that these neighborhoods do not have opportunity. The people in these neighborhoods a lot of times feel helpless and hopeless. So when something like this happens, that anger and that irritation comes out. And until people in these neighborhoods get opportunity, this is going to happen. It's going to continue to happen. So something needs to be done. We have to help each other. We're all Americans, no matter what color we are, and we have to give people opportunities to feed, clothe, and take care of their family.
Ishmael.
I agree. I agree with that wholeheartedly. You see oftentimes that these type of things happen in the lower class neighborhoods where people don't have that opportunity. They don't have that funding. They're worried about what they're going to eat. They're worried about whether they're going to be able to pay rent. And this is where we see the worst treatment of the citizens. And I think part of the reason for that is because they have less resources to fight back. Again, St. Louis has 91 municipalities in St. Louis County. And a lot of those municipalities, they have quotas on whether it's traffic tickets or whether it's arrest or whatever, and so they're trying to meet those quotas for, I guess, the funding purposes or whatever, but they attack those who don't have the opportunity. So until we're able to get on that level playing field, until people are not so upset, you know, at law officials, where they feel protected instead of preyed upon, then this type of thing will happen. The good thing about this situation now is the world is watching. So, again, you can't deny it. You have to address it.
Thank you so much for being with us, Ishmael. We'll continue to follow your writing on this, and thanks for all your reporting.
Okay, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Ishmael Sistrunk, he is a columnist for the St. Louis American, an African-American newspaper that has been published since 1928. He has written some, we like his piece, Walking While Black, Michael Brown, Black Men and White Police Officers. We will post that on our Facebook page so everybody can have a chance to see it. We continue with our discussion. We're going to be talking about racial bias in the decision to shoot. Our guest joining us momentarily, Professor Joshua Carrill, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at University of Colorado Boulder, and he looks at the association between race and the idea of threat. How do we develop biases as individuals? Where do they come from? And perceived threat, what does that mean? And we'll look particularly at police reactions and ask if he's looked at those as well. So all of that is coming up. Welcoming more of your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Professor Joshua Carrill. He is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder, and his research looks at the association between race and the idea of threat. And he's used a video game for this, and it's very interesting findings. We'll also be welcoming more of your phone calls. Professor Carrill, thank you very much for being with us. Why don't you just start by explaining what you have done with video to look at this relationship between race and the idea of threat?
We developed a, like you said, a little video game, and it is a very very bad video game, very poor video game, but just it's like a slideshow where people sit and watch on a computer screen as images appear, and there'll be just, you know, background scenes, a building, an apartment building, a strip mall, something like that, and periodically a person will pop up in one of these video games, and one of the backgrounds, it's a male target, either white or black, and he's holding something. And sometimes he's holding a cell phone, or sometimes he's holding a can of Coke, or sometimes he's holding a pistol. And the player's job is to shoot the bad guys. So they just do that by pushing a button on a keyboard or pulling a trigger on a video game controller to shoot the bad guy. And if he's not holding, if he's a good guy, if he's holding a cell phone, they have to press a separate button labeled "Don't shoot." So that's it. It's remarkably simple. But the results are very consistently demonstrate a bias to shoot the black targets more quickly and more frequently than the white targets.
And who's been doing the shooting in the games?
Well, we have tested this on thousands of people at this point. We started with we started with just regular college students. So I'm a psychologist, and that's usually who we start studying. College sophomores, so we tested them, and then we have expanded it to look at members of the community. We've tested the community in Denver. We've also done web-based samples that cross the country, and we have, as you hinted at, we have also tested police officers.
Where did you Where did you work with police officers and? You found exactly the same results with them, or something different, about the same, or what?
Our police officers, we first began working with the Denver Police Department, who, to their credit, actually approached us about getting involved in this research. Right, yeah. And that was a really interesting project. We've learned a lot working with them. But we've also tested groups of law enforcement, again, from all over the country, from the area in the Northwest to the area in the Southeast. So we've taken this as far as we people will let us, I guess.
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the second part of your question was: does police officer performance look the same as everybody else's? And so let me just back up again and say that when we look at most people, what we see is that when we present, say, a black an armed target. Participants shoot that armed target more quickly than they shoot the same armed target who's white.
Oh.
If we look at the unarmed targets, the participants are actually faster to say to choose the don't shoot option, to say don't shoot if the target is white rather than black. Mm-hmm. But they're also, and this is the maybe the most concerning part, they're also more likely to shoot the unarmed black target than the unarmed white target. So we see racial bias in kind of two different patterns. We see it in terms of how quickly they can respond. If the targets kind of fit the cultural stereotype that young black men are dangerous, if they fit that stereotype, participants respond very quickly and very accurately. If the targets deviate from the prototype, from the stereotype, if we are looking at an armed white target or if we're looking at an unarmed black target, participants are slower and they're more likely to make a mistake. And what that means is that they're more likely to shoot the unarmed black target than the unarmed white target.
Well, you're a professor of psychology and neuroscience. Can you give us an understanding of where those biases that a lot of people seem to have come from?
It's a really tough question to ask. Actually, most of the time we try to there are probably lots of different influences. Stereotypes can come from they can come from a kernel of truth. There can be a piece of the stereotype that is true. But they can also be things that we create spontaneously that are not, that don't have a real strong basis in fact. There can also be kind of a combination of a true kernel and the less rational operation of our minds, where we build on the kernel of truth and we make it seem like it's more than it is.
Mm.
So a lot of people, when I present this research, a lot of people ask, isn't it true that black people commit more crime? Doesn't it make sense for police officers to use that information? And that gets at this kernel of truth idea, that maybe there is a part of it that is true. But just to show you how hard it is to really answer that question, a lot of the discussion I think that you were having with Ishmael before this involved the idea that there's a bias in the way that the police may be operating. So even if more black people are arrested for crime, does that really mean that they're committing more crime, or are they just being differentially targeted, differentially arrested for
right.
the same kinds of behavior? And I'm not trying to say one way or the other. What I'm trying to point out is that it's really difficult to tease apart exactly where these stereotypes come from.
Yeah. What about Ishmael was talking about, well, he was taking to task the black community in some ways for their looting, the response in the stores and burning down the Quick Trip, and also for some rap music, which is misogynist and kind of violent, and on the other hand, also mentions the killing of Trayvon Martin in the same time they're kind of glorifying violence, reality shows with African-American women kind of going at each other. How much of popular culture may feed those biases that we have? Is that a significant thing or not at all?
We have studied a few different kinds of influences, including like news media, and so I can talk with very great detail about those. We haven't tested things very carefully, like rap music. We've taken a little peek at it, but here's the upshot. Our general sense is that anything that ties a racial category, say black people, with an idea like violence, anything that does that. Whether it's rap music or news media or a joke that you hear, like whatever it is, that link is the problem. That's what creates this tendency to shoot. So and that creates some real problems. It could be based on truth. There could be truth behind the stereotype, but there might not be. It could be something that you personally believe, one person truly believes that black people are more dangerous, but another person might not even believe it, but they just know that the stereotype exists. They know that there's a link between blacks and threat in American culture, and that in and of itself can prompt this differential, this racial bias in the decision to shoot.
Mm. And
so, I would say that, music and TV and movies can have a really... there's at least the potential that they have a very detrimental effect.
Yeah, and not only a decision to shoot, a decision to pull somebody over for, a headlight that maybe the police officer thought was gone, but it wasn't. They're just trying to figure out, why are you in the neighborhood? What are you doing here? When are you going home? Where do you live? That
Absolutely.
Kind of thing.
You just look a little bit more suspicious, a little bit more, I don't know, something's wrong with that.
Yeah. What do you think needs to happen in Ferguson? We're having a change in police response today, order from who knows exactly who decided, but it's a very different situation. But in terms of addressing biases, police perhaps over response to this, who should be doing this? Who should be talking about it in Ferguson?
Who should be talking about ways to change things?
Yes, yeah. You should be there, don't you think?
I don't know. I think that we've worked a lot with police officers, and we're generally we want to be very careful about recommendations that we make, because as horrible as this is, and I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like. For the family and even for the community as
right.
a whole to deal
yeah.
with. Police have a difficult job to do. And they, you know, again, we've worked with a lot of them, and I'm sure, you know, there are definitely bullies out there on the police force. But my overwhelming sense is that they are people who are trying to do a difficult job to the best of their ability. I don't think that most of them are in it for the wrong reasons. I think that they're trying. And if we make recommendations that lead them to hesitate when they're dealing with somebody who really is a threat, that's not a good solution either. So police have to respond quickly, and they have to respond in ambiguous situations. It is a very, very difficult job. And I don't know that we understand enough to make solid recommendations. The one thing that our research is beginning to converge on is that training needs to be more realistic.
Mm.
Training does seem to do so. Police do outperform us on these kinds of decision-making tasks. They are better. And in some ways, they actually show less bias. We think that has a lot to do with training. And but the problem is training often occurs in kind of very bad simulations, like our simulation, like our little video game. You know, the police are standing at a firing range and they're making these decisions about paper targets. That's not realistic. Or they're using a video simulator that gets closer, but is not the real kind of threatening environment that these people are going to actually have to make their decisions in. So the one thing that we are particularly curious about, and I'm going to say it like that because we don't have strong evidence yet, but what we're really curious about is the idea that if we could train people in an environment that comes as close as possible to the environment where they're actually going to be performing making these kinds of decisions, I think that has the potential to do some good. That has the potential to help them use the right information and help them not use the wrong information.
Professor Joshua Carell is our guest this part of the show, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder, and we're looking at the association between race and the idea of a threat. He described that simple video game and the fairly profound results to that. Here's how you reach us. We have time for a few more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Kathleen in Waukesha, hi.
Hi, I have two incidences that I'd very briefly like to outline, and one of which happened, one of my godsons played basketball for the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and we had been at a family reunion, and he had a curfew of some sort. We'd been out of town, and I got pulled over by the police because of like a burned out tail light or something. And I was concerned about him getting to his curfew on time. And he was within less than a mile, say, of the dorm where he needed to be. And I said, well, honey, why don't you just get out and you just run? And my godson is African American. And he looked at me as if I had lost my mind. He's like, are you crazy? If I run and there's a cop here, I'll get shot down right away. Mm. And this is a child who had been drafted by Bo Ryan was a graduate of Rufus King, had great grades, and he was obviously smarter than I was when it came to appropriate black police behavior, because he knew that, or he assumed he would get in big trouble. And on another incident, which involved me, I work doing vendor work at different parks around the city, around the state, but in Milwaukee during the summer. And one night I was the last person packing up my belongings, and all of a sudden there was a group of six young guys, all African-American, and the shortest one was probably about 5'10". They were teenagers, and one of them was like 6'6". And one of the guys was really snarky with me, and I have coached football for the Northside Y in Milwaukee, where predominantly all my kids were either African-American with some Asians and very few whites, and I did that for 9 years. Well, this one guy was being kind of snarky, and I was not afraid, but I was cautious as I continued to pack up all my wares. And then but I was all alone, me and these six kids. And the one guy was being snarky, and the one boy says, "Hey, man, dude, leave her alone. She saved the life of your girlfriend. If it wouldn't be for this woman here, you would have no girlfriend at all." And it's true. I had saved this little girl's life when she was 9 months old. And then I turned and looked, and I'm like, "Oh, I know who you are." And he was here. So here's this young African-American male coming to my defense and to get the other guy to just be legitimately polite. And there was no incident. And I travel anywhere. I've done different kind of works in all parts of the city. And I feel as if I own the city.
All right. I need to hold you there because you've said important things and we have a lot of calls. Joshua, you want to respond?
Well, yeah. I mean, in response to the first part, it's the about the, you know, getting out of a car that's been stopped by the cops. I actually had a very similar kind of experience, you know, talking with the officers who have participated in our studies. I was like, yeah, I always thought that was okay. You know, like I never really worried about it. I'm a white guy. And the police officers were very quick to point out, you know, white or black, if you get out of a car, if you get out of a car that the police have stopped, you put them in a very vulnerable position. They don't know who you are. They don't know if you're a good guy or a bad guy. They're immediately in the situation where they have to try to make a judgment about what's going to happen. If you pull a gun and start shooting at them when they're, you know, in their seat belted into their squad car, they can't possibly defend themselves. So they respond very, very nastily to that kind of situation. And I was explaining my, you know, this revelation to a friend of mine who's black, and he was like, "You are such an idiot." Like, young black men learn that before they learn how to drive. You know, like they learn that right away. So, and again, you know, is race a cue? I mean, is race a cue that is making that sense of threat worse? We don't know for a fact, but it sure seems plausible.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. We need to move to Jim in Mukwonago. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just had a question. I wanted to know if there was a difference between the white officers and the black officers, or if they came up with about the same response.
Yeah, interesting question.
There is not much of a difference between them. And
really?
If you think about what that means, that actually ends up being a really interesting point.
Yes.
Again, we live in a culture that communicates certain ideas about race. Some of those ideas we may personally believe. Some of them we may personally reject, but we know about them. Even people who reject the idea of the stereotype may know about it. And that link in and of itself may be sufficient to create these kinds of biases. And so when we look at personal attitudes, sometimes they end up predicting, you know, we can tell who's going to show more bias and sometimes who's going to show less. But people who are aware of the cultural stereotype that links young black men with threat, those people typically show more bias in our studies.
Mm.
And that can be, black people can be aware of the stereotype even if they don't believe it.
Joshua, thank you so much for being with us. Fascinating study. Thank you. Joshua Correll, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. Jason from Chicago, I'm sorry we didn't get to you. He is a police officer who said he wants to remind people how difficult it is to make split decisions, which, of course, happens in that line of work all the time. Well, that was an interesting hour, wasn't it? Here's to a quieter time in Ferguson this afternoon and this evening. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour.